You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Outside of India's capital, on roads coming into it, large groups of farmers have blocked access to major roads. Their grievance, their justification, is that the government is pursuing a series of agricultural reforms that would transform their way of life and potentially render farming a non-viable way of living for some of them, large numbers of them. This is not just an issue of a few tinkerings at the edges. It speaks to a major fault line in Indian politics and life, and more broadly, the nature of Narendra Modi's transformation of the Indian government and what it says about the future of the world's most populous democracy. And that's what we'll talk about today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Zach Beauchamp, here with Alex Ward and Jen Williams.
Hi.
What's going on? Look at us doing agriculture. Just a big new thing for us.
I mean, I like farm animals. I like those things. They're good. I like a cow, a pig, alive. You know, as worldly listeners who are kind of know, I'm a vegetarian for basically moral reasons. So I'm like really down with being nice to the cows.
I eat meat for delicious reasons.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. It's not actually about meat eating, right? That's not what these protests are about. It is about three specific laws that the Modi government has introduced that would reform the process for selling Indian agricultural goods, which is right now regulated in a particular and very confusing way, and then would shift this towards a less regulated, but still regulated, but confusing way that also seems to benefit large companies at the expense of small farmers. But before we get there, we should probably talk about what the Indian system is in the first place. Alex, why don't you walk us through the background necessary to understand what's going on here?
Absolutely. So this is a very complex, somewhat arcane system that we're going to uber simplify here just for expediency. So let's say a farmer grows wheat, right? The farmer would take some of that crop and take it to what's called a mandi, which is like a centralized storage / selling location, wholesale selling location. The government guarantees prices or minimum prices for that sale of wheat. So let's say, and let's use American dollars here, like that bushel of wheat costs $10. Again, I'm oversimplifying. So that is the minimum the farmer could get. And that's helpful to the farmer because no matter what intensity of labor they put in, no matter how really good the crop is, they're basically guaranteed that level of revenue, right? So that actually helps farmers sort of plan out their life. Like if I make X amount of wheat, I get, you know, Y amount of dollars in. And this was done for multiple reasons in Indian history, mostly because it is an incredibly agrarian agricultural society. For a time, it was like 50% of the economy, and it's still a pretty hefty chunk. And so this was meant to like just help farmers live and sustain their livelihoods and continue to grow food. Also just for in a large, large country, you know, make sure that there's enough food for everybody. That was basically the system pretty much, right? Once the wheat was bought, it would go to, you know, certain stores or other wholesalers or whatever it may be. But that was basically the system, is you were guaranteed a certain price. Now there's a reform to this for the basic premise of, this was all well and good, and it is helpful for farmers in some way and helpful for the government to sustain a level of food coming in, but it is wildly inefficient because this is the government basically setting prices and not allowing for a market to grow. And so This was something Modi, who came into power saying he wanted to revolutionize India's economy, he wanted to or modernize it. And so in part for those reasons, but there are others which we'll get to, he and his government rammed through three pretty big changes to that system that I described.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things, though, that you need to kind of understand is that there was a middleman here, right? There were basically brokers who kind of act as the middlemen between the farmers and these markets. So in order to be able to actually sell in these markets, even though it's guaranteed, you have to basically, you know, get like a license and you have to go through these kind of brokers. And they take a cut because, of course, they do, right? They're facilitating this, you know, buying and selling. But a lot of farmers say that they take more than just a standard cut. And because there's all this kind of middleman in between, by the time that the farmer's like product actually gets to the final end point, there's a lot of kind of waste in the middle in terms of labor, in terms of money, sometimes even in terms of the product. And so part of what these reforms are meant to do is to cut out the middlemen. Without getting too technical into these three laws, because, you know, again, we're not going to go too deep into the weeds of agricultural policy and the specific legislation. But basically, under the new policies, farmers will now sell their goods and make contracts with independent buyers outside of these government-sanctioned marketplaces that Alex was describing. So those, you know, were primarily where farmers did their business. Now they can do things like contract farming, which is making a contract between the farmer and an independent private buyer to say, I want you to grow X amount of wheat, you know, and give it to me by X amount of time, and I will give you Y price. You know, before, again, they couldn't do that. They had to go to these markets. The benefit of that, obviously, is that they can, you know, negotiate, that these private buyers can negotiate. Ideally, it'll, you know, one, make things more streamlined, more efficient. And two, ideally, again, the farmers will be able to, you know, negotiate a better price. The farmers, however, are not convinced that this is going to work out this way. And they're really concerned that these, you know, minimum support prices are going to be gone, that they're going to end up being, the farmers are going to end up being at the mercy of large corporations that will pay really low prices for these crops, thereby, you know, plunging them into debt, financial ruin. So they're really worried about this, right? Now, the government has said that it will not drop these minimum support prices that Alex was describing for essential crops like grain, things like that. These are the prices the government has set and guaranteed for decades. But the farmers are still really concerned that that's not the case. They're really, really worried that, you know, essentially by bringing in private business, they're going to be wiped out. You know, again, most farmers are small farmers. They're not these huge, you know, corporate industrial farms. So they're worried that by bringing in private business, essentially they're going to be, or many of them are going to be wiped out. And as Alex said, this is a huge deal. Okay, so more than half the workforce in India makes their living in some way related to agriculture. For comparison, in China, that number is 25%. So India, 55% roughly. China is 25%. In the US, it's 2%. So just to give you kind of a sense of like how big agriculture is to the Indian economy. But farming is also incredibly unproductive, and the sector actually only accounts for about 15% of India's GDP. So that's where the government is coming from. And they're like, look, we need, for our economy to be sustainable, you know, we need these massive agricultural reforms. But they're big, dramatic reforms that most economists, experts, and the Indian government say, look, this is long overdue, this is needed. And the farmers are like, yeah, you know, maybe we get that, but it's going to cause a lot of pain in the short term. And we don't trust you to do the right thing by us and make sure that we don't lose out here.
It's also important to note another aspect of the bills that we haven't talked about as much, which is that it modifies the limits on grain storage that currently exist under Indian law. So there were rules about how much you could stockpile. And the reason that you have these rules is because if somebody with a lot of money decides they want to stockpile a lot of grain, then they can basically control the market to a degree. And a lot of these markets are very local and very not very well integrated into any kind of national framework. So an individual player in the realm who stockpiles a lot of grain could have a significant amount of influence over prices. This, the second of the three reforms, modifies these limits and makes it easier to store lots of grain. Now, in some ways, this makes a lot of sense, right? Because that would reduce wastage, which is allegedly a serious problem in the Indian farming situation, right? If you can't store enough grain, then you waste a lot of it that gets produced if it's not sold by necessity or not consumed. You increase the storage limits and you reduce wastage, right? That makes sense. Except then there's the other possibility, which is that somebody who wants to reshape the market according to whatever their own particular interests are can start stockpiling a lot of grain in order to do so. And the reason I bring this up is not just to get further into the very exciting technical nature of the bill, though I think that's really important to understanding the whole situation. It's to underscore that the system is attempting to deal with real problems, right? The Indian farming system as it exists right now is not anyone's idea of how a market is supposed to work. Right, these middlemen at the markets end up taking unpredictable amounts of prices, which can sort of mess with farmers' expectations of what they're supposed to earn, which is really important, and also can end up with them profiting for basically no reason. There's no really good national market. The regulations are all sort of local and patchwork and sometimes very informal, and that makes it difficult to create efficient supply chains and distribution mechanisms, and basically makes everybody worse off across the country to a degree, right? So the goal of these reforms, in theory, is to create a unified national market in which grain and agricultural products are distributed efficiently around the country without hurting small farmers. The concern, as Jen was just articulating, is that first of all, it doesn't do that. Right. So even if you allow transactions to take place outside of these individual markets, well, then you just have these people meeting under opaque circumstances, negotiating without a lot of information about how the rest of the market is supposed to work, because there aren't good mechanisms in these new bills for establishing a kind of unified national grain market or any kind of selling thing. So you don't really know what other people are doing. You don't have a good sense of what the national market is like. And as a result, prices are based on negotiations between individual parties who are contracting with each other. And if you're a small farmer having to deal with a big corporation, chances are the big corporation will figure out a way to set prices and the terms of the agreement in a way that disadvantages the small farmer just due to differentials in bargaining and negotiating power. And so the reforms don't necessarily accomplish that goal, and they do it in a way that seems specifically likely to benefit big players at the expenses of small ones, which is why farmers are angry enough about them to be protesting. That's one of the reasons, right? There are lots of reasons, but it's worth emphasizing this is an extraordinary step, right? Farmers blocking roads outside of the capital is not like normal politics. These are people who believe that their entire way of life is going to be wiped out by these bills.
Yeah, and just to note, it's not like they've been there for a couple of days. They've been there for literally months, camped out. Several have died by suicide since the protests have begun. Others have died from exposure. Some have died from COVID. So this is very serious. This is literally people's livelihoods, right? Which is why, you know, it's a very, very passionate issue.
I mean, yeah, let's take a step back here, because this matters, right? I mean, if you're the government, you're thinking that this is short-term pain, right, for long-term gain, that if we're going to modernize India, you need to make these kinds of trade-offs. Not everyone's going to be happy. That's why they're trade-offs. But you don't have to be the person who's getting hurt to be happy about it, right? Like, if you're the farmers, you are having your entire way of life, your livelihood, the way you've done business, not only, you know, and it might not just be you. It could have been your parents. It could have been your grandparents. It could have been a family farm that you've been living off of and sustaining off of and even feeding your community from for decades. And if that is under threat, if everything you've ever done is under threat and could be changed because you've got government reforms and possibly larger corporations, you know, messing with your prices or and with your business and your livelihood, then of course you're going to be angry. And they're also angry because of the way this was done. Like, if you're going to do big reforms like this and you're the government, you're going to want to usually bring in, like, you know, farmers and farmers unions and companies that sell their goods and all that. That didn't happen. These reforms were just pushed through with very little consultation, or almost no consultation, with that community. And then when farmers heard of this and were like, hey, can we at least have like a discussion here? They were told no, like, just deal with it. And so you saw that this became an organic movement. to basically say, like, we don't want our government to dictate how our livelihoods operate here outside of, you know, the prices. And they're letting their voices be heard in this case, coming down to the cities, blocking roads, almost forcing the government to listen to them. And to the point that the government has now said, like, hey, you know, we'll delay these 18 months or so. But that's not the demand that these farmers want. They want these laws scrapped and perhaps a small amount say, well, we're willing to discuss like a potential reform, but you can't just ram through something that would change our livelihoods completely. To give one very quick sort of analogy, obviously the American farming system and the Indian farming system are very, very, very different. But America was also a large agricultural society. Most people in America were farmers. And what happened is our market started to liberalize and market reforms were enacted, is you saw the number of small farmers decrease tremendously. But the like ability for farmers to farm and their productivity grew. And that was because of mechanization and like the size of farms grew. Why did this happen? Because private companies came in, basically threw out a lot of small farmers, screwed them over on prices, said, this is mine now, and completely changed our industry. And I would be shocked if, you know, the Indian farmers, knowing the reforms that are being thought about here or being put forward, aren't thinking about the American example or examples in Europe or examples in China or examples everywhere, because this is a pattern wherever these kinds of reforms happen. And by the way, they're important to make a country's economy grow. I'm not knocking that. There is a like an actual sort of macroeconomic reason here. But on the smaller scale, right, again, if you're just a family farmer, if you're that small farmer and you've been feeding your family and your community for years on that plot of land, and this is the future you're seeing and you're worried about, and it's being thrust upon you with little discussion.
The analogies to other countries and to the U.S. and to the shifting away from agriculture is kind of resonant here. So one of the things that experts actually point to is just that there are too many farmers, that there are too many people in India making their living off of agriculture, and that that's not sustainable going forward. Obviously, again, if you're a farmer and people are telling you there are too many farmers, okay, well, you know, yes, obviously you may want to just continue farming if that's your family business. But some people may say, okay, well, what are the other options? The problem is that in India, there aren't as many good other options, primarily manufacturing. And that's a really big deal here. So in China, you saw kind of a transition away from farming to manufacturing, but that's because China developed its manufacturing sector big time so that there were jobs and opportunities for people to actually transition to new work. But in India, they haven't been able to do that. They haven't been able to generate that kind of manufacturing growth that's needed to support millions of farmers in transitioning. So in 2020, manufacturing actually only accounted for about 17% of India's GDP. That is not nearly enough to support a wholesale transformation of millions of farmers moving away from agriculture. So it's kind of on top of that, right? And then just to add insult to injury, you have all of the anxiety and tension and economic downturn related to COVID, right? So you have small businesses closing at rapid rates, which means the economy shrinking, which means their, you know, jobs are getting even more scarce. Meanwhile, the government comes in and shoves these reforms through. And it's incredibly likely that many farmers will lose their farms, go further into debt. You know, the debt problem of farmers has already been an issue that has driven many to die by suicide. It is a serious issue. And so it's not just these reforms, right? This is taking place in a broader economic context where farming is being squeezed, but there's not another kind of outlet for, you know, sectors where people can go for new work.
It's also worth underscoring how small the average farm is in India. Like we've been talking about small farmers in sort of an abstract way, but like they really don't have a lot of bargaining power. About 86% of farms in India are under 2 hectares, which translates to around 4.5 acres. Per farm, right? So the average size of a farm in the United States, to help underscore the difference here, is 444 acres. The average farm is about a little under 100 times larger than the vast majority of farms in India, which says a lot, right, about not only how vulnerable these people are, but how inefficient the system is. Right, you have all these people on lots of little individual plots of land working on their own in their own way and then trying to sell it on their own separately, not as part of a broader market, but as individual actors in these systems, right? It's just, it does not make very much sense. And there are probably way too many people from an economic efficiency point of view who are in farming right now for the reasons that Alex and Jen just articulated, in addition to this efficiency problem of there being tons of small farms. But without a better mechanism for transition, what you have is lots and lots and lots of small people who would, in a more efficient system, be crowded out, losing their livelihood without any compensation. And so, again, that's why it makes sense to camp out on a road outside of the capital for long periods of time, and to the point where you're being met with violent crackdowns by the government, right? People have been hit with water cannons during these protests and beaten. There's at least one report of a female farmer who was detained and sexually assaulted by the Indian police during her detention. Like, these people are risking a lot, but they're doing it because their entire way of life, of being a small farmer, is under attack by the new bill. Right, from their point of view. And whether or not something like this reform is necessary, in their eyes, these specific reforms, in the eyes of, frankly, a lot of economic observers, these specific reforms are a bad way of going about the needed change for India. So we're going to take a quick break here. And afterwards, we're going to talk about the politics of all of this, including how Rihanna, yes, the Rihanna, got roped into all of this.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prof G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prof G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prof G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome back, worldly listeners. We have been talking about India's farming protests. And, you know, for now, we've been focusing on the agricultural reforms themselves, right? Giving you the update on Indian farming policy that you need, not only to understand what's going on, but like need in your life, because Indian farming policy is really, really important for millions of people. And it's a topic that does not get a lot of attention until farmers literally block roads going into the capital and get beaten up by police. In doing so, right? So now we're going to talk about this more political aspect of it, right? Like, why is the government responding with such heavy-handed tactics? And in general, what does that say about the way that India is trending under Narendra Modi? So, Jen, I want to start with you, right? Like, first of all, how would you characterize the government's response? Is calling it heavy-handed accurate? It certainly seems accurate to me.
Well, it's complicated. So, you know, they have allowed the protesters to march peacefully. They have, like we said earlier, you know, agreed to meet with the farmers and have tried to kind of figure out ways to make concessions, sort of, by saying we'll delay them. But on the other hand, they also have done things like, you know, trying to cut off the internet and try to, you know, actually crack down with tear gas and water cannons, like you said. Part of what happened, there was an escalation of sorts, basically at the end of January. So there's this holiday in India called Republic Day. It commemorates the signing of India's constitution. The Indian government had approved a plan for the farmers, who, again, have been in the streets protesting for months, to actually enter the city of New Delhi, the capital, and, you know, have a big kind of protest march. Something happened. It's not totally clear where the march went off the rails, But essentially, it seems like there were miscommunications. Some of the protesters began marching toward the Capitol a few hours ahead of schedule. And then they ended up having like a clash with police who were like, hey, you're not supposed to be doing this until later. Police ended up using tear gas and batons to try to turn them back. It turned into this kind of whole conflagration of battles kind of breaking out across the city. One farmer was crushed when his tractor. So the farmers have actually literally driven their tractors to, like, when I say they're camping out in the streets, a lot of them brought their tractors. So one farmer was crushed in the melee. At least like 19 people involved were injured. Some were sent to the hospital. 86 police officers were reportedly injured. So it was this huge kind of fight. They also entered this historic Red Fort that's in New Delhi, and they raised this flag. And the flag is basically an important kind of symbolic flag to India's Sikh community. So a huge majority of these farmers are Sikh. If you remember, Modi's government is very kind of Hindu nationalist. And so this incident at the Red Fort kind of became this flashpoint escalation in everything. A lot of people kind of turned on the farmers and saw this as, you know, there were comparisons being made to the Capitol insurrection with people taking over, you know, this Red Fort and holding up flags. It was, I would not make that comparison personally, but there were some people who were making that comparison, a lot of them supporters of Modi. And because a lot of the farmers were holding this flag, there were accusations from some of the kind of Modi-supporting Hindu nationalist crowd that these weren't actually farmers, that they are now terrorists, that they are Sikh separatists. They are Khalistani, as they're known. And it kind of turned into this really ugly other thing that moved it away from an actual debate about Indian agricultural policy and into this kind of broader culture war fight about Modi's kind of Hindu nationalist agenda for the country and these predominantly Sikh farmers. And it got really, really ugly. And then Rihanna decided to tweet.
So Rihanna comes in and tweets a CNN article, and she's basically like, why is no one paying attention to this? And of course, because Rihanna has over 100 million followers on Twitter, people start paying attention to this. You know, even Greta Thunberg, the climate activist, got involved. But it essentially, you know, it should be said, sorry, Rihanna, people were talking about it. Vox was covering it. So were a bunch of other outlets.
Including CNN, because she tweeted it.
Including CNN, right. The article you tweeted out. But because she tweeted about it, people were, you know, once again focused on it. What I don't think she expected was the amount of hate that she would get from trolls online, from the Indian government itself, from supporters of Modi. And the reason why that matters is, yes, celebrities get trolled all the time, but there is a machine kind of that supports Modi no matter what. You can almost think of it as like the MAGA trolls here in the US. It's a rough comparison, but if you're familiar with that, you'll get it. There were attacks on her personally, some doing, I don't even want to say them, but some saying that, you know, past issues that she's had with a pop star were warranted, which of course is gross, that, you know, she is just fully doesn't understand that she's, you know, like secretly an agent for whatever. And this is just nonsense, but it's nonsense that helps Modi's case. I mean, he does have this online army, a pretty strong level of support within the media in India to do things. And it's, and it can be weaponized in this way. And there's a reason for it. It works.
Well, look, Alex, I don't even, like, I don't think you need to dance around it too much, right? It's not just that it's an independent group of people who get angry at anyone online. It's that it was literally sponsored and created by his party, by the BJP, right? There's a bunch of reporting from around 2015 that you had defectors from people who had been former Indian trolls, at least one that I can recall reading an account of, where she said that these troll factories, these centers where people would coordinate these attacks from were directed at their targets by BJP operatives, right? So it wasn't just that a bunch of people really love Modi and they attack anyone who wants to criticize them. It's that there's clear evidence that the government has been cultivating this as a strategy for delegitimizing dissent for a long period of time, which I think speaks to the real agenda of the Modi project right now, which is often I think very easily missed, right? Because Modi is not, at least in his Western appearances, he's not an idiot. He's not flamboyant. He doesn't seem like somebody like a Trump or a Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who is flagrantly corrupt and anti-democratic and brutal and cruel. Again, at least in his international appearances, there are a lot of differences when it comes to politics inside India. But he has been very effective at using the tools that modern authoritarian leaders or wannabe authoritarian leaders in democratic states use to marginalize dissenters and weaken them. And one of the areas in which he's been especially adept is policing online spaces and weaponizing them without it looking like you're, you know, pulling a China and straight up censoring the internet. Right. It's more subtle than that in cases like this, and is indicative of somebody who has an agenda to undermine the foundations of Indian pluralism and democracy without wanting to catch the costs internationally that are associated with doing so.
Yeah. And, you know, on top of that, you know, he's also fanned the flames of Hindu nationalism in a very real way. So it's not just that he's like paying people who don't actually care about this or something to go tweet. He has fanned these flames throughout the country and, you know, riled up this very rah-rah Hindu nationalism, this very, you know, pro-Modi kind of army. I think that the MAGA example is actually pretty apt for people in America to understand. But a lot of these people are very serious, right? And during this Rihanna kind of brouhaha, one of Bollywood's most famous actresses tweeted some really ugly stuff. Probably the least ugly one was she said, "Sit down, you fool," and was basically making fun of her for not knowing what's going on. It got a lot uglier. She tweeted out some risque photos of Rihanna, basically calling her all sorts of names and slut shaming her, essentially. It got really, really ugly. But this is like one of Bollywood's most famous actresses, right? This isn't just like some random troll in somebody's basement, right? Like there were, you know, articles and opinions and op-eds published in major Indian media outlets accusing Rihanna of being a paid shill, essentially, like Zach, you know, alluded to earlier. It got really ugly really, really fast. And a lot of it was online, but a lot of it was also, you know, IRL, right? Like in the media and from, you know, people who very much have kind of swallowed this line from Modi and were pushing this. And the Indian government, you know, as we alluded to earlier, came out and made a statement of their own. Now, they didn't name Rihanna or Greta Thunberg, but they basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, international celebrities should maybe do some research first before, you know, wading in on the minutiae of Indian agricultural policy. And in that respect, they actually had a point in the sense of, you know, I'm not sure whether, you know, Rihanna or even Greta Thunberg were actually fully versed, understandably, in the actual real debate that we laid out in the first half of the show, right? There is a serious debate about how to reform India's agricultural sector. But what they were responding to a lot of times, these celebrities, including Rihanna and others, was the crackdown and like the internet shut off and how the government was treating the farmers. And so that's, I think, more what they were responding to and saying, like, this is a bad thing that we should support these protesters, right? Rather than actually weighing in on the agricultural policy decisions. So, you know, there were legitimate criticisms. One expert was criticizing Greta Thunberg, who's obviously, you know, big climate activist, but for saying that, well, she should actually be more aware that some of the farming practices that the farmers are fighting to defend have actually poisoned the land and are very, you know, not green friendly, et cetera. So there was kind of more genuine criticism of saying like, hey, there's a real debate here and you guys don't really know what you're talking about. So maybe, you know, take it easy versus the really nasty, ugly, racist, sexist, horrific trolling that happened on the internet. But this all kind of combined to create this big kind of culture war fight and laid this like ethno-religious kind of nationalist fight on top of what is an actual genuine policy debate.
I guess I wouldn't give the government that much credit to say like they had a point when they responded, just because like at least Rihanna's tweet was, why aren't we talking about this, as a point to her, as opposed to like her taking a stance. I think it's just convenient for them to shove off any, you know, famous attention on this. Look, Modi staked his entire leadership on modernizing India, making it like the great, you know, make India great again, and to shorthand it, revolutionize the economy, make it a strong player, have it be the counter to China, make it a strong ally of the United States. And he's stopping at nothing to do so, to the point that he will weaponize these ethnic tensions, these religious tensions, to his ends. He will push through laws that he feels are necessary, despite the fact that a bunch of people are going to be upset with him. And he's going to be fine allowing a media and social media ecosystem defend him at all costs, no matter what they say, no matter how ugly or how dangerous it gets. This is on him. Like, let's be clear. There's a genuine policy debate here at its core. I'm not denying that. That is very obvious. And there is a lot of reason for India to modernize and to grow and to reform. But he's not going about it the right way. He's going about it in the heavy-handed, in the authoritarian, in the incredibly dangerous way that he is. And this is the problem. I was heading in that direction, Zach, although I'm glad you stepped in. That like this is the government strategy when it looks bad for him. And let's be clear, this is incredibly embarrassing for Modi, right? To have a bunch of farmers, thousands of farmers, come in from the north of the country down into the capital and defy him openly and for months. This is incredibly damaging to his reputation, incredibly embarrassing to what he's trying to do, and of course harmful to his own project. So for him to like, he's throwing everything at the wall to make sure that it comes out in a successful way for him. And he doesn't really care what happens to his society in the process. He feels like the grander vision that he has, the great man of history vision of himself that he has, is worth all of this. And it's just not. And he's brought this crisis upon himself. And while I agree that there are reasons for reform and the farmers have a point here and the government has a point here, like, was all this worth it? Was this really the way it had to go? It didn't have to go this way. And kudos on Rihanna to point out at the excesses here.
So, look, I want to take issue with one part of what you said, which I'm not sure you intended, actually, Alex, but is that the way you just constructed it and positioned it, it was like the primary goal of Modi as a political actor is to do economic modernization and advance India's foreign policy. And the ethnic tension stuff is ginned up in order to help win support for this program of modernization and globalization and, you know, stronger foreign policy and whatnot, right? And I think that doesn't give it quite the level of importance that it has in Modi's agenda, which I actually think centers on not the stoking of ethnic tensions, but in establishing like an ethno-religious hierarchy in India. Right. So Modi emerged out of the RSS, which is a Hindu nationalist movement that had a paramilitary wing. Right. The BJP, his political party, grew out of the RSS. Right. And these are people who believe, in contravention of India's founding doctrine and ideas, which is that a country so diverse requires an extraordinary amount of ethnic pluralism and tolerance and mutual acceptance in order to function as a cohesive society. He believes that India is stronger when Hindus are given pride of place in official Indian institutions. This is like the central belief of Hindutva, the doctrine that the RSS and the BJP ascribe to. And so Modi is rearranging Indian institutions, including stripping citizenship from people in a predominantly Muslim part of the country. And he's doing that because he believes that India is strong, India is great, it's powerful when it is a Hindu civilization, when those beliefs and those people control its political institutions, and when the official doctrine of pluralism that originated with independence is shattered and broken. And like that is the goal of the BJP. They have other goals, right? Economic modernization is a different plank of his platform and one that's much more defensible. But like, ultimately, I don't think that he's just strategically ginning up hostilities with the sort of Sikh minority in this context. So that's certainly part of it. It's not just a strategy. It's an outgrowth of their normative ideology.
No, you're right. I didn't mean it as like it's a thing that he just conveniently uses when he wants. He uses it because it's part of what the BJP is up to and what he feels. I would just say like he knows, at least for his country and for the world, like, America's not going to love Modi because he creates India into a Hindu state. It's gonna support him, and other countries would support him if he happens to modernize India's economy. Of course, Modi does seem to have a lot of support for his full platform, right? A recent election, he did pretty darn well. It was basically a landslide. So he's leaning into which I agree is a top priority for him, this Hindutva nationalism in the in this economic stuff. He's leaning into a whole bunch of things, and he's able to throw a bunch of stuff at the wall when things go badly for him because he's got so much support, because this is already where he believes, and he's got this sort of army of on social media in place. This isn't a side project. It is the project, but I believe they're in tandem.
Yeah, and you can see this play out very specifically in this Twitter kind of drama, right? Again, you know, it was a conversation about a policy change, right? About reforms. And then, you know, Rihanna's tweet was actually mostly in response. The CNN piece was basically about them shutting off the internet to try to, you know, stop farmers from protesting and things like that. And she was like, why aren't we talking about this? There's a lot of outrage and, you know, solidarity with the farmers because of the way they're being treated by the government, you know, seeing as these people were trying to express their legitimate grievances and free speech and that they were being cracked down upon. And it immediately, as soon as this happened, this troll army basically attacks. And you can see how quickly it turned into the religious kind of Hindu nationalist narrative, right? So on one hand, they're calling her like, you know, basically accusing her of being a Sikh separatist, which people on the internet were also laughing. People who didn't support, you know, this were like, never thought I'd see the day when Rihanna was being accused of being a Sikh separatist. This is fun, you know, obviously sarcastically. But
that famous Barbados Sikh cell.
Right. But then there were also trolls who were suggesting and questioning, is she Muslim? Maybe that's why she's doing this. For the record, she's not. But it very quickly turned into this really ugly fight. And you can see the kind of strains of the domestic political fighting and cultural, you know, kind of transformation and the Hindutva ideology being kind of overlaid on this totally other issue. And in part because, you know, like I said earlier, most of the farmers are, you know, they're predominantly Sikh. And it's just, it's really fascinating, I think, to see talking about the future of Indian democracy and the future of Indian politics. It's really disturbing to see how quickly a legitimate policy debate became dominated by this super unhelpful, really nasty kind of political, cultural, social fight. And it now essentially subsumed the legitimate debate underneath all of that, so that now everyone's fighting over, you know, Sikhs are now worried about being attacked for this. It's become this whole other fight when it should have just been a legitimate policy fight. And I think it speaks to, you know, the future. It's a bad sign, I think, for the future when there are going to be, as you said, you know, additional reforms. Modi is trying to reform the Indian economy. There are going to be additional reforms. And the problem is that, you know, for me, when I see that, it's like, well, anyone who tries to express legitimate dissent is going to immediately be attacked on these completely other unrelated grounds because Modi has weaponized this as a means of pushing back on dissent.
I think we're just going to leave you there. I want to thank our producer, Sophie Lalonde, for all of her hard work on making our audio sound good every week. And I want to encourage all of you to rate, subscribe, and review Worldly wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.
Riri. Hey, Mr. Modi, don't screw the farmers. Hey, Mr. Modi, won't you let the farmers farm?
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.